It's almost universal, whether it's two wheels, four wheels, 18 wheels, no wheels. So many of us have a special memory involving a vehicle or a story about a car we've loved. Even if you can't tell a crankshaft from a driveshaft, I want to hear the story of the vehicle that moved you. I'm Blake Jackson, and this is Autobiography. Next guest on Autobiography, old friend from the Kinsman days in Red Deer, and had all sorts of vehicles, so I've been looking forward. Please welcome to Autobiography, Greg Ganske.
Thanks, Blake.
So, Greg, what is the vehicle that moved you?
The vehicle that moved me, I actually still own. It was my very first vehicle that I drove when I was 16. So the story starts in Rocky. I'm 15 years old, and my dad and I go to look at a truck for the acreage, because he needs an old truck to haul stuff to the dump and just kind of have an old truck around to haul stuff. And so we go look at this old truck, and it's a 66 Chevy truck, and it's blue and black and white and primer and dented and rusted. And
just going to pause for a sec and tell you about Greg's truck. Another of the much-loved CK series, the 66 GMC was part of the first generation, which began production in 1960. This was the first year for the independent front suspension, giving the truck a car-like ride. Through the years, the truck boasted both fleet side and step side boxes and power plants ranging from the 3.8-liter inline six to the 327 V8 small block.
So I'm looking at this thing going, man, this is probably the ugliest truck I've ever seen. And so we end up buying the truck for $500, and we get it home, and the guy had some extra parts for it. And so anyway, I was 15, and dad and I worked on this truck in the garage, and we changed the cylinder heads on it and did a little work, got the carb tuned up and got it running pretty good. And so I was allowed, we lived about a mile from the dump, and I was allowed to take the truck over to the dump and back. And so I would, you know, sneak over there and do the dump run every week and that kind of thing, and thought it was pretty cool. And so that ended up, when I turned 16, the dad had made a card for me. My dad worked away in those days. And so in my birthday card was the key to the truck taped in the card. And so that was my 16th birthday present, was the old truck. And so that was pretty cool. And so what happened after that was my dad would go away for a month at a time to work, and he'd come back, and I'd have the truck apart in various forms of disarray, and of course in his garage, and his truck would be outside on the driveway. And so he'd come home and, you know, what the heck are you doing? And I think secretly he was proud of me that I was working on it, fixing it up, but kind of frustrated at the same time that his vehicle's out in the snowbank. So anyway, the truck, yeah, so it kind of was a labor of love, and I worked on it through high school. And back in those days, without the internet, it was a little trickier to find parts. We would scour the bargain finder and the auto trader pages and try to find a parts truck here and there in a field. And so kind of gathered pieces for it, a hood here and a fender there, and just kind of did it that way. And so I did most of the work myself. Dad helped me, of course, and we swapped the motor in, a different motor in out of an old Impala that we bought. And then I did as much body work as I could in the garage, kind of sculpting with body filler and doing what I could to fix it up. Had a body shop, you know, kind of fix up the cab corners and stuff for me, the stuff I couldn't do. And yeah, anyway, I primed it and did it. I actually painted the interior. We picked a Porsche red color. I sprayed the interior in the garage, and then I made a deal with a local body shop, and they agreed to spray the truck for me for $300 if I brought it in basically ready to paint. So I had the truck in primer, and I pulled the bumpers off and did what I could. And so rolled it in, and they sprayed it, phoned me a couple days later, said, okay, come get your truck. And so a buddy of mine came with me, and we put the bumpers on out in the parking lot and peeled all the masking tape off it. It was kind of cool. So it was then my shiny red truck. And so I drove that truck through high school, through college. I drove that truck to the ski hill. I drove that truck camping. I mean, I did anywhere I went, it was in that old truck. And so having it all these years later, I mean, it's just every time I get in it, I'm 16 again. So just pretty cool, you know, to still have it all these years later. And of course, all my friends and family remember it and love to see it and go for rides still. And so it's been, yeah, it's been a lifelong love of mine. And I did redo it again in the 90s because it had suffered a lot of winter driving in Alberta, and of course got more rusty. And so I did end up doing another rebuild in the 90s, but it's basically been pretty much the same since 96. It was actually registered to my mom for a long time when I was a kid, because insurance was cheaper. So when the cops pulled me over, I had one cop tell me, he said, hey, tell your mom, nice truck. I was like, yeah, thanks.
You mentioned doing a lot of work on it. How much of the original truck remains?
So when we got it, this is kind of a funny story. So the truck, it's a short box step side truck. The engine, the guy that we bought it from had put in a Chrysler engine, a Dodge. It had a Dodge 383 engine in it when we bought it. And so all the extra parts we got were Dodge engine parts. And so we ended up originally fixing that Dodge engine up to run. And it actually ran. It was quite a strong engine. We changed the heads, and they were a higher compression cylinder head and stuff. And once we tuned it up, the thing would smoke the tires like for three blocks. It was actually, I think my dad was freaked out because it was a little too fast. And so when I did start redoing it, we bought an old Impala from Sylvan Lake for, I think, like $275. Used the motor and tranny, put the 350 Chevy back in with a 350 auto. And dad sold that motor to his friend that was rebuilding a Charger. And so I thought it was great to have the big 383, but dad wanted it to be a Chevy motor and drivetrain again. So that's what we did. And that motor remained in it till college. The cab came from, so I was having a hard time finding body parts that weren't rusty here, because it was still like in the early 90s, it was still hard. Nobody made replacement parts. And so I drove, at that time I had I'd inherited my granddad's 79 Chevy truck. And so I think I was 20 or 21, and my girlfriend and I hopped in the truck and we drove to Phoenix in search of rust-free truck parts. And so we drove down. It was a bit of an adventure, and we stopped in Vegas and looked around. And again, we're scouring bargain finders and that kind of thing. There was no Craigslist and Kijiji then. So every town we got to, I'd look in the yellow pages and call auto wreckers and ask around, and you know, just that's what we do. And then we got to Phoenix, and I called an auto wrecker, and he said, you know what, I just got a truck yesterday, you should come out and look at it. So we drove to Maricopa, which is just south of Phoenix, and looked at this truck, and it had a pretty good cab, rust-free doors. And I talked to the wrecker, and he said, you know what, tell me what you want, and we'll take it off. You can come back tomorrow and pick it up. And so I ended up with the cab, doors, inner fenders, rad support. And I think that was about all I could fit in the back of my other truck. So that was what we took anyway. And I think it was like $500 or $800 US I paid the wrecker, and then hauled all that stuff home. The only original body parts on the truck are probably the windshield cowl where the wipers come through, and there's little kind of corner pieces at the end of the hood, and then the steps for the box, I think, are really the only original body panels left on the truck. Everything else was replaced.
Now, a lot of people, I work on a truck as well and do work on my own vehicles. And listening to your story of replacing a few motors and all these body panels and doing painting and bondoing, any advice for people who'd like to strike out like this but just don't know how? How do you learn how to do this? What's the best way?
Well, I think now there's so much more of a community of hobbyists and people that are into, whether it's cars, trucks, whatever you're into. I just think, you can, whether you're on Instagram or whatever social media is your favorite. For me, I like Instagram because I can follow guys that are kind of into the same thing I'm into. And I've met a lot of people just from, even from Instagram, where, you know, I'm looking for, I'll even advertise on there. If I'm looking for a part, I'll post it, and somebody somewhere will reply and say, hey, I know a guy, or somebody will reply to me and say, yeah, I have one of those, or I know a guy that has one of those. And so it kind of starts like that. And then I think as far as learning, I mean, you just kind of jump in, and I still YouTube lots of things. I've forgotten stuff that I used to know. I think when I was 16, I don't know how, I think just from hanging over the fender with my dad since I was about 10, I picked up a lot of things from him. And so when I was 16, I wasn't afraid to take things apart and figure out how it worked and put it back together. And it just always, for me, came easily, that stuff. Yeah, that's my story. That's my truck story. That's one of my truck stories. But that's my favorite one. That was probably the most influential in my early stages of the hobby, for sure.
Right on. This is exactly why I started the show. I love hearing about stories like this. It's been with you forever, and it's obviously meant a lot. Hopefully you can come on again, because it does sound like you have a lot of knowledge to share, and you're passionate about vehicles.
Would love to. Thanks for having me, Blake.
Thanks, Greg. There's Mr. Greg Gansky with tales about his 66 GMC short box step side beautiful truck. And it must be, because he's kept it his whole life since he was, well, before he was 16 years old. Very cool, Greg, and I hope I get a ride in it someday. I'm Blake Jackson. Thanks for tuning in for the Autobiography Podcast, and it's time for our next Myth of the Machine. Our next guest, it is Challenger Dave from Red Deer Cruise Night. Welcome to Autobiography, Dave.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, I have, Challenger Dave, I have an inkling of what you're going to talk about, but Dave, what is the vehicle that moved you?
Well, I guess being the nickname Challenger Dave, the vehicle that has moved me has been my 74 Challenger.
Just going to pause for a sec and tell you about the 1974 Dodge Challenger, which, according to myself and millions of others, is part of the most attractive model of vehicles ever built. Produced from 1970 to 1974 and positioned to compete against the Cougar and the Firebird, the Challenger and its brother car, the Cuda, were powered by everything from the Slant 6 to the 426 Hemi to the 440 six-pack. After being discontinued, the line was revised in 1977 as a rebadged Mitsubishi Lancer for a few years, and then again in 2008.
Over the years, I've owned many, many different hot rods and different classics, things like that, just even everyday cars. But the Challenger seemed to just grow on me. It handles amazingly and has taken me everywhere I've wanted to go without giving me any major problems.
Where did you buy the Challenger?
Actually, I found it through the Auto Trader, and I found it down in Calgary in 1998. I'd come into a little bit of money when my dad passed away and figured it was time to get myself a new hot rod. So I drove down to Calgary, and I was mistaken. It was kind of funny, actually. I got down there with a buddy, and I was mistaken. I thought the car was only $2,500, but the guy wasn't going to part with it for any less than $2,900. So this is obviously a Sunday when I went down there, of course, because nothing's open back then. So hummed and hawed, made a couple phone calls, and my uncle actually that lived in Calgary was able to lend me the extra $400 to be able to pick the car up and help me get her home, because they had to give me a few bucks for fuel money too.
I think everyone who's been to a cruise night has seen your Challenger. Yellow.
Yep.
with the Lemon trailer.
Yep.
What sort of condition was your Challenger in when you picked it up?
The Challenger wasn't in too bad a condition. It was still more or less a stock condition, except it looked like about mid-80s, somebody took the car into their high school body shop and painted it. It had an interesting, I'll just say, paint job on it. When I picked it up, it looked good, but I needed something different. So in 2000, I ended up getting the car repainted. This car is also, I think I've put three engines in it, two transmissions, and four different gear sets into the rear end. Just because when I bought the car in 74, they were a very basic car by that time. The muscle car era was dying out. So the car came with a small block Dodge with a little two-barrel carburetor on it, stock exhaust, and 273 highway gears. So it wasn't anything for a performance car, but it was a nice rider. And then when I got a hold of it, I wanted it to perform a little bit better. So started looking around at different gear ratios. And a lot of these numbers won't mean a lot to your listeners, but some of them it will. I went from a 273 to a 323 to a 355. Now it has a 373 Sure Grip in it. Sure Grip is just the Dodge pronunciation of a posi track.
Yeah, which of course is a GM rear end.
Right.
I love all this terminology too, and I hope I can get more people into it. We should do a glossary at the end of the show for all this.
There you go. It'd be a long one.
What's your best memory?
Best memory? I've got quite a few memories of it. Probably the best memory was about 5 years ago or 6 years ago. Things were just getting too much for me, and I needed to go on a little bit of a holiday. So I just grabbed the car and the trailer, and I headed out to the mountains, and I put 5,000 kilometers on the car through the mountains with the trailer in about 2 weeks. I just drove and drove and thought and just enjoyed life driving instead of worrying about all the hassle that was going on at the time. One of the best things probably on that trip, one, it's very unique looking as it's going down the road with a 74 Challenger hauling this little yellow pod behind it. The car got a nickname of the Wasp, only because it's yellow and black. And the Wasp are, not sure if I can say this on the radio or not, but Wasps are nicknamed assholes, and you never know when this little car is going to bite you in the butt. So we just went with that because it kind of had the thorax with the pod on the back. So she can be a little mean when she wants to be, but usually she just likes to cruise. But when we're going through the mountains, there was an area, I don't remember exactly where it was after Revelstoke, but it was a very, very windy road through the mountains, and they actually had a 90 kilometer hour listing on that road. And with the pod behind it, it's not the easiest thing to see behind the car. So as I was going around the corner, I looked in the mirror and I saw probably 30 vehicles behind me that were kind of choked that I was taking so long to do the speed limit because, unfortunately, as I've realized in the past, BC cops have a tendency to really keep an eye on Alberta cars. So anyway, I was cruising the speed limit and everything else, and I had all these cars lined up behind me. Must have been, like I said, about 30 of them. And looking in the mirror, I'm seeing BMWs, Porsches, Audis, all kinds of stuff that love the mountains and the high corners. So we got up to these things, and I said, fine, you want to play? And I just punched it, and I did about 110 through all of these corners. And I looked back, and none of those cars were on my butt. Now, I know they can handle those corners no problem. I think maybe I just made them a little nervous seeing a classic muscle car with a trailer flying through the corners like it did. So, but I had a lot of fun with that. But yeah, there's been quite a few little tiny stories like that that can really get me going. Another time we were going out to a wedding out by Raven. There was about three cars. That was the only classic. And it was when I first got the car. It was about 2001. Still hadn't done a lot of work to the suspension as I have now. On an undisclosed empty highway, a buddy of mine decided, hey, let's race. So we're giving her. I look down at my speedometer. I'm doing over 100 mile per hour, and I hit a bump, and the front end came up off the ground and kept lifting like it was going to want to flip me over like an airplane because it caught all the air. So I just eased off on the brake, came down, wobbled, and slowed down and he goes, I won. And I said, you can win, man. I almost flipped my car. So, you know, there's been some interesting times with it for sure, you know. And it is very, it's just an awesome car to drive. It really is. If you've ever driven a Challenger or a Cuda or both, in this regard, you would probably find that the Challenger actually handled a little bit better than the Cuda. They had a little bit longer of a floor pan in them. Believe it or not, it was only a couple inches longer, but it actually helps them handle a little better in corners.
Do you think you'll keep the car forever?
Probably. I've dumped a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into this car. And honestly, if they allowed it, I would probably want to get buried in it. I know that they don't allow that kind of stuff, but I would sure prefer it. If it didn't happen that way, then I'd definitely, you know, put the car onto one of my nephew or my niece or something like that, because they've kind of fallen into it, and I'm sure that they would take care of it and keep it going.
How do you know you can't be buried in your car?
Actually, I've just seen reports that you really have to look into it. I've read stories over the past where there has been people buried in a glass box and sitting on their motorcycle and things like this, but there's a lot of permits that have to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. As well as when you're burying a vehicle, then you have to make sure that all oils and seals and everything like that are removed so nothing can drain into the earth.
Yeah,
things like that. You know, if you own your own property and you don't tell anybody, yeah, you can probably get away with it, but I don't own that much property.
You know, I actually wanted to keep my dad's ashes in an air cleaner.
In an air cleaner?
Yeah.
You could do that.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be that difficult, actually.
I still may do it. He had a 427 Impala, so that big Chevy air cleaner, that big chrome one with the orange sticker. I think that'd be a great idea.
Yeah, you could. Basically, if you were just to, this is a weird conversation to get into, but if you're basically just to hollow out the center of the air cleaner itself, like take the rubber cover off, clean out the center, put a plastic channel in it, you could put them in that way. The other option is you could put a clear plastic around the outside of the air filter rather and seal it in with silicone, put his ashes around the bottom or inside the air cleaner itself, and then seal the top. That way his dust and his ashes don't come out of there. But you could seal that up like that. I don't think it would be that difficult if you looked into it.
No, you're not going to hear this kind of thing on Ellen, are you?
Definitely not.
Any other vehicles in your sights, anything you'd like to pick up in the future?
Oh, well, are we talking with or without a lottery win?
If you won the lottery.
If I won the lottery, I'd have a Quonset full of certain vehicles. I've always wanted a Superbird, the original Daytona Superbird, the Daytona or the Superbird. Either one would be fine with me. Now, for your listeners that don't know that one, they'd have to look it up, but it has a big wing on the back and a nose cone. And it was... For the period of time when it was racing with Petty, he couldn't be beat with that car. Then the NASCAR decided to limit the wing on the back and things like that and change it so it was a little more fair, I guess you could call it. But the Daytona and the Superbird, they're a dream car. An original 70 Challenger with a Hemi in it and a six-pack Hemi or, you know, any of the above, I would just be drooling over. I am a Mopar guy. I'm not going to, you know, put down any other rides because I have driven different vehicles from every brand. And as a lot of your car people will probably attest to, once the brand finds you, it doesn't let you go.
Cool stuff from Challenger Dave, a.k.a. Dave Burden, a.k.a. the guy with the yellow and black 74 Challenger. That's it. Pretty much every Red Deer Cruise night and Sylvan Cruise night, and looking forward to many, many more of those events. Dave, thank you very much, and check out what they're up to at reddeercruisenight.com. That's reddeercruisenight.com. And thanks again to Greg Ganske for telling us about his 66 GMC pickup, the one he's had since he was a wee little boy. And I'm Blake Jackson, and I thank you for being here. If you have a story about the vehicle that moved you, let us know. We're on social media everywhere. You can email me, autobiographypod@gmail.com, and slip into my direct messages or whatever. Whatever works for you, okay? No, I'm going to try that last part there. Yep. If you have a story about the vehicle that moved you, let us know. We're on social media. You can email autobiographypod@gmail.com. We would love to have you on the podcast, whether it's a Porsche or a Pinto or a Lamborghini or a Lada. If you had fun, if you love that vehicle, I want the story. But till next time, keep your wheels on the road and a tarp on your load.